Good afternoon and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello, welcome to the Ides of March edition of The Outspoken Cyclist. Ed 2, Tim McKenna.
It's supposed to be warm, right?
And?
Well, it's still springtime. It's still Cleveland. It's still cold. It's St. Patrick's Day coming up shortly, and it's going to be 28 degrees.
In fact, St. Patrick's Day at John Carroll University at WJCU is a very, very important day. Do you know why?
No. Why is that?
Because Greg Pretty, our sound engineer, and Fred Dolan, better known as Uncle Fred, spend 18 hours.
18 hours?
In the air studio, giving us more Irish music. It is all your Irish music for an entire year. 18 hours they are going to take requests, and they do from all over the world. So if you're interested in hearing your favorite Irish music, listen in on Monday, St. Patrick's Day, March 17th, and you can call in, and you can email, and listen in, 88.7 FM. I know people listen from all over the world.
Well, there's never any Guinness or any alcohol involved in our show.
Right.
18 hours of Irish music, there's got to be a little bit, I'm thinking.
You know what? You'd have to ask Greg and Fred. I'm not sure there's drinking allowed in the studio. On the other hand, I'm not sure if you could not drink.
Well, that's more like a cough syrup. That's not necessarily drinking.
Well, that's Guinness. Keeping that throat, you know, and those beautiful melodious tones.
Absolutely. Yes, 18 hours of Irish music. I'm Irish, and okay, that's enough.
That's true, you are.
Yes.
That's right. McKenna, yes, of course you are. So, you know that Tuesday, last Tuesday, I declared it was spring?
Yes.
Yes, so there isn't anything else happening. It is officially spring.
Absolutely.
It's been an interesting week in the bicycle world. We're going to share a lot of it with you this evening. In light of several of our recent shows and the loss of life we have reported on over the past year, I wanted to let you know about a pending bill in Congress. So get out your pen and pencil if you are interested. The League of American Bicyclists issued an action alert, which they do on their website from time to time, and via Facebook on Wednesday to bring attention to the Bicycle and Pedestrian Safety Act, H.R. 3494/S1708. So when the Bike Summit delegates went up to Capitol Hill last week, one of the asks was that their congressional representatives sign on to a critical bill that would require the U.S. Department of Transportation to establish a specific target to improve the safety of bicyclists and pedestrians. In their infinite wisdom this week, the Department of Transportation issued a proposed national traffic safety goal that doesn't have any inclusion of a specific target or goal for the reduction in the number of bicyclists and pedestrians killed on our roadways. There are several cities around the country that are adopting bold targets of zero fatalities in their communities, and the LAB feels that the federal government might want to get behind this goal. If you have any interest in this issue, if you want more information, including how to contact your congressperson, log on to bikeleague.org. So, moving on. We have three guests this evening. Two are bringing us good stories, and one not such a good story. 2 weeks ago, you might remember, we spoke with Rails to Trails President Keith Laughlin. At that time, we discussed a case that was brought before the Supreme Court that could impact already existing trails as well as some that are on the drawing board. We expected a decision to be handed down sometime this summer, but we were totally surprised when it came down this week. In an 8-1 decision, Trails lost. We'll talk with Keith about what it all means, as well as the one dissenting vote in a moment. And then we're going to head on out to Boulder, Colorado. We're going to talk with Zach Vanderkoy. I hope I said that right. From People for Bikes. Zach is heading up the project called the Green Lane Project. The initiative is helping U.S. cities build better bike lanes to create low-stress streets. We'll find out what that means, what cities are on the list for assistance from PFP this year, and why this initiative is at the top of the list of projects that PFP is involved in for 2014. Finally, we are going to speak with a gentleman by the name of Mike Cobb about his project, Disaster Relief Trials. He's out in Portland. So I want to know what happens when you take a cargo bike at 100 pounds of relief supplies, an obstacle course, and a map, and you send a bunch of riders on their way. This was Mike's idea to grab people's attention to the possibilities of what a cargo bike can bring to a disaster area when infrastructure is compromised due to a disaster. We'll find out how a DRT works, why it might be just the saving grace during a disaster. We have some news, and then we're going to wrap it up and remind you one more time about our Irish Marathon on Monday. So let's get over to Washington, D.C., and talk once again with President of Rails to Trails, Keith Laughlin. Hi, Keith. Let's talk about what happened with the Supreme Court this week.
That sounds good. Okay. It's great to be back. I would rather be back under somewhat different conditions.
I understand. Here we are again, only 2 weeks since the last time we spoke. We had no expectations of the Supreme Court rendering this decision so early. Fill us in again on what the case was. I know it was Marvin M. Brandt Revocable Trust et al. Versus the U.S. What happened?
Well, it's a complicated case, but it basically had to do with a corridor in Wyoming along the Medicine Bow Trail where there was an adjoining landowner named Marvin Brandt, and there was a question over whether or not he, as the adjoining landowner, owned the corridor that the rail had been on, or if that corridor had been retained by the federal government. Because this was a corridor that had originally been federal property. Most of this happens in the West. This is where the federal government owned almost all the land west of the Mississippi, and with an 1875 act, began to give land to the railroads in order to build the Intercontinental Railroad. At the same time, it was giving, in the Homestead Act, it was giving land to individuals to settle that area. And so the question is, if the railroad no longer runs on that corridor, does the corridor go back to the federal government, or does the adjoining landowner get the corridor? In this case, the Supreme Court sided with the adjoining landowner.
Wow. You guys came out with a statement about the decision. Can you paraphrase that for us, and then we'll start to fill in the blanks? And I really wanted to also talk about what Justice Sotomayor said, because it was very interesting, I thought.
Right. Well, I mean, I think that we're very disappointed by this in terms of our statement. We're very disappointed in this ruling. We think that it is erroneous. Part of the ruling also remanded the case back to the Tenth Circuit Court, and we will be continuing to fight this case going back to that court and making our case before that court, trying to narrow the decision. So this isn't entirely over with, but I think the majority of the decision will likely stand. What this then means is that we have to be very, very vigilant in that, and this only applies to a subset of rail trails.
Okay.
Any rail trail that was that has been rail banked, which means protected under a specific federal law passed in 1983, is not affected by this.
How many of the trails are not affected then? Most of them?
We have about 20,000 miles of rail trail in about 25% of them are rail banked, which means that 25% is not affected. In addition to that, it's quite unlikely that anything east of the Mississippi will be affected.
Uh-huh.
Because most of this had to do with federal land west of the Mississippi that was given to the railroads to get to California with the Intercontinental Rail System.
So this Marvin M. Brandt, whoever he is and whoever his family is and his revocable trust and all of that, what suddenly came upon them that they want this land? It's not that they're actually going to develop it, I would think. It sounds to me like there must be money involved.
It's hard to tell.
Okay.
It could be either they want this land as a way of preventing the trail from being contiguous to their property or going through their property, or it could be that they are interested in extorting the government to get the government to pay a large sum of money to allow the trail to continue to go through their land.
Okay. Well, we can all come to our own conclusions with that, I guess. Yeah. So let's talk for just a moment about Justice Sotomayor. She was the just singular dissenting vote, and she did say something interesting. She was quoted as saying the court undermines the legality of thousands of miles of former rights of way that the public now enjoys as means of transportation and recreation. Lawsuits challenging the conversion of former rails to recreational trails alone may well cost American taxpayers hundreds of millions of dollars. How would that work?
There are a lot of uncertainties in terms of what is going to happen as a result of this decision. The one certainty is that it will cause a boatload of litigation and lawsuits, because along these corridors, you will have a certain class of attorney knocking on every door saying, do you want to sue the federal government? And so we'll just have to wait and see how that develops. But we know there's going to be extensive litigation on some of these trails. But as I said, most of them are in the West. If they're rail banked, they're already protected, and they had to have been federal property at one point. This is a subset, but we don't know how big that subset is, because nobody, not Rails to Trails Conservancy, not the federal government, has any records to know how many of these corridors there are or how they were developed.
Then how did the Brants figure out that this was so? I mean, who dug into this to suddenly say, wait a minute, here's this, oh, because it's a new trail, Medicine Bow, huh?
Well, I think you can do it on a trail-by-trail basis.
Okay.
That's not that difficult to figure out, but in order to estimate the impact, you need to have a broader notion of how many of these there are, and that we really don't know.
Okay. Well, certainly Justice Breyer had sort of a comment that really a lot of people in social media thought was pretty ridiculous. He said, I certainly think bicycle paths are a good idea. For all I know, there is some right-of-way that goes through people's houses, you know, and all of a sudden they're going to be living in their house and suddenly a bicycle will run through it. What the heck was that?
I was sitting in the oral argument when he said that, and I was just astounded that anybody sitting on the Supreme Court could walk into an oral argument that's just this serious and be so uninformed and say something so ridiculous.
So it was an 8-1 verdict against us, basically.
It was, but it was one of those things where it hinged on technicalities that really had nothing to do with us. I mean, it was one of these things where in a 1942 Supreme Court case, the Justice Department had actually argued they didn't own these corridors, that they were easements for a different reason, and I don't even fully understand why. And so now they were contradicting something that they had said earlier, number one. But there was federal legislation passed in the 1910s that said if these corridors should become inactive, these corridors shall remain in the public domain. But the Supreme Court ignored that law.
Nice. Well, that was nice of them to just ignore it. So where are we going to go from here, Keith? What's next, and what can the cycling community do, if anything, to voice an opinion here?
Well, the cycling community can do an awful lot. We will be tracking case-by-case places. We've been already in touch with many of our partner groups at the local level, particularly in western states. We're looking through the inventories of their existing trails and trying to determine their status so that we can determine which ones might be in jeopardy. So that's kind of number one. Number two, on the policy side, this is the kind of thing that energizes anti-trail, anti-bike interests. And so we could very well be facing legislation in the Congress to do something like repealing the Rail Banking Act, which is the most effective way of protecting these corridors for trails. And so we will have to be increasingly vigilant in terms of doing that. And I don't want to sound like a Pollyanna, but I think in the end, this decision will have created so much outrage among so many people at the local level who love their trails that we will use it as a way of creating such a furor that we minimize the damage from this really bad decision.
Well, we are going to watch this. We will continue to watch it. you know, it's very disconcerting that after all the work, after all these years, after all the use of trails, and I have a wonderful story to tell you, a conversation I had with Brian's dad about a possible trail in the Adirondacks. And I'm hoping that it happens.
I know that story. I know that trail well. We've been working there.
And I'm hoping that it happens. You know, they want this little railroad to continue, you know, which is, and I was trying to explain the economic impact of a trail. And I went back to a trail, the Lehigh, is it Lehigh? A D&L trail in Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
I went back to that trail and I found some statistics. And because I asked you for some, and in the meantime, I found some.
Right.
And sure enough, I said, look, this is the economic impact of these trails. You're crazy to not want it to happen.
I think the state of New York agrees with you also, and
oh,
they
good.
Actually own that corridor. So I think
yeah.
what you're suggesting is what's going to come to pass. We've been working on that project for quite a while.
Well, good. All right, Keith. Well, we'll keep in touch. Whatever goes up on Rails to Trails, we'll take a look. It's railstotrails.org. Keith Laughlin, thanks so much for talking to me this evening.
Always a pleasure, Diane.
All righty. Take care.
Okay. Bye.
Bye-bye. Keith Laughlin, president of Rails to Trails, joined me from his offices in Washington, D.C. Tim, what do you think?
Well, unfortunately, every time that lawyers get involved, things get interesting. But it's funny that they have to go back to laws from 1924 and regulations and things like that. You would think it would be simple.
We're going to take a real quick break. We'll be right back on The Outspoken Cyclist, and we're going to talk with Zach Vanderkoy out in Boulder, Colorado from People for Bikes. Good afternoon, Zach. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Diane. I'm really happy to be here.
We're going to talk about People for Bikes Green Lane Project. Tell us how you're involved and what the project is, please.
Sure. People for Bikes Green Lane Project is an effort to catalyze protected bike lanes in American cities. So these are new school, next generation protected bike lanes where there's some kind of a physical barrier between moving traffic and people on bikes. And we think they're fantastic. So we're working with six American cities to help them get more of them on the ground.
Are these sometimes called cycle paths?
One of the terms that's commonly used is cycle tracks.
Okay, cycle track. Okay.
Yeah, we prefer the term protected bike lanes, but it's a synonymous, same thing.
And how does it work? You start with say, the person's lawn. Let's start with the sidewalk side and move to the street. Where does the protected bike path come in the progression as you move toward the actual lanes where cars are traveling?
Okay, well, they come in a variety of different flavors,
okay.
depending on the street. But generally, you will have a sidewalk. Then you will have some type of dedicated space on the street for bikes. And usually in American cities, that's on the street level, not on the sidewalk level. Then you will have some kind of a barrier. It could be parked cars. It could be plastic bollards. It could be landscaping or trees or planters. And then you'll have your moving traffic on the other side of that or your parking lane.
Got it. So you are actually separated from traffic on these. How wide normally would one of these paths be, these lanes?
I think if you have the luxury of a lot of space on your street, 6 feet would be a nice width, although they can be narrower because there's always a lot of competition for space on streets.
Yeah, no kidding. I know you're working with six cities this year. How do you determine which cities you're going to get to work with People for Bikes? And I know there's technical assistance and dollars involved. We'll talk about all that.
Sure. Well, we had a competitive application process.
Okay.
And we had over 100 cities express interest.
Wow.
We got 60 full applications. And what we were looking for are the cities that are poised to lead, to be national models, and are ready to make the most progress in a very short time, just 2 years. The Green Lane Project is kind of a talented and gifted program. It's not for the laggards. We wanted to work with and invest in the best and brightest in order to shine a spotlight on their progress in hopes that it will advance the craft for making better bike lanes around the country.
This is not the first year you've done the Green Lane Project. I think there were six cities last year, too. What kind of time frame and what are you expecting those cities to do within that time frame?
The cities, their projects are locally driven.
Okay.
So, we're not telling them how to design anything or, you know, telling them what they should do. They're bringing their projects to us that they have planned and in the works. And our role is to help them succeed. So all the package of resources that we offer, you know, including technical assistance, strategic assistance, networking, we help cities see what's going on in other peer cities through, you know, face-to-face workshops and study tours. So we're basically catalysts. You know, we're throwing twigs onto a fire that's already burning and shining a national spotlight onto it.
Pick one of your cities from last year, say, and tell us what the project was briefly and what happened in the space between then and then the new grants being or the new projects being, you know, looked at as possible of the 60 applications you got.
Sure. Well, we started in 2012 selecting our first class of cities. You know, that was Portland, San Francisco, Chicago, Austin, Texas, Memphis, and Washington, D.C.
Okay.
And in that time, from 2012 until 2014, the number of these protected bike lanes that are on the ground in the United States almost doubled, with most of those coming in those new cities.
And how many miles would you say that, just an average, do you have any idea of what that is?
It's hard to say because some projects, you know, are quite long. They can be a whole corridor, you know, of a mile or more. But sometimes it's even just one or two blocks can make a really big difference in network connectivity. If you have a really comfortable place, you know, an off-street path or a comfortable bike lane on a lower speed street, but there's just that one block section that doesn't connect. You know, one short project can make a big difference. So it's hard to evaluate based on number of miles.
Yeah, we see a lot of that here in Cleveland where, you know, it doesn't go anywhere. And then, you know, you have to cross a bunch of streets or do a lot of things, and then you can get to the next part. So I understand perfectly what you're saying, and that's such a good idea. How are city governments reacting to these projects? Are you getting any pushback or assistance? I mean, what are you seeing mostly?
A lot of enthusiasm.
Oh, good.
Yeah, I mean, you know, like I said, more than 100 cities were interested in this, which means that they are at least thinking about adding protected bike lanes to their toolkit for streets. And, you know, we're really focused on these protected bike lanes because we think they're transformative and we think they're the missing tool in the American street. You know, they are the tool for big, busy, scary streets, you know, where a lot of people just don't feel comfortable even with a nice bike lane because there's just nothing but a little bit of paint between moving cars and people on bikes. So we're really focused on this one particular innovation, but realizing that it is part of a network that includes all these other pieces of infrastructure along with the programming the cities are doing. So, you know, about how cities are reacting, they're really enthused to see what other cities are doing. And we learned that there's not a lot of opportunities for cities to do that. You know, that no one wants to be the first, but everybody wants to be the second.
That's an interesting point. I'm speaking with Zach Vanderkooy. He's with People for Bikes Green Lane Project. So who got chosen for 2014? What are the six cities? I know for sure Pittsburgh is one of them.
Yes, Pittsburgh is one of them. We were really impressed with the ambition and depth of the projects that Pittsburgh has in the works. The others are Boston, Atlanta, Indianapolis, Denver, and Seattle.
Nice. So that brings, if this is year three, that brings the total to 18. You had 6 and 12, 6 and 13, and now 6 and 14,
oh,
right?
No. Actually, no. So it's a two-year campaign.
Oh.
So we choose six cities to work with for 2 years.
Oh.
Yes.
Oh, I thought it was 1 year. Okay, so it's a two-year project. All right, so what happens within those 2 years? What do you help them do? Start at sort of the beginning when they fill out their application and then move? What is the end goal? And just kind of walk us through the process if you can.
Well, the end goal is to get more good quality protected bike lanes on the ground. And that's really important so that they can be studied, they can be evaluated, they can be experienced, so that more people can use them and hopefully that will translate into even more demand for them.
Okay.
So, you know, like I said, our strategy to advance this innovation nationally was to choose six leaders. And within each of those cities, we want to help them realize the goals that they've already created. So the energy behind these is already there. They have political support. They have really good staff, smart staff, who are willing to figure out some of these challenges with design. They have community support, business groups, and others. So they all have the magic ingredients in place to be very successful. What we offer is to modest grants, not a lot of money in terms of transportation budgets, but we do have some money available for them to help them get their projects on the ground. We offer study tours, so we bring their leaders to other cities in North America and in Europe to see successful models in action. And we offer chances for them to meet face-to-face to share their best practices, their lessons learned, chances to realize that their challenges are not unique, and it helps advance everyone. It helps them to move more quickly when they know that others are dealing with the same problems at the same time.
Exactly. So let's say you got 60 applications and you chose six, so that's 10%. The other 52, are there resources that they can get from People for Bikes, from the Green Lane Project, even if they weren't chosen to be part of those six?
That was one of the most agonizing things about this selection process. It was excruciating because we had so many great applications.
Yeah.
To choose only six. So one of the – there's a great power in focus. And I think in bike advocacy and in a lot of things, we tend to try to do too much for everyone. And one of the real strengths of this project is that we are really disciplined about dedicating our resources. That being said, I think a lot of these other cities that have really good projects in the works – cities like Lincoln, Nebraska, and Richmond, Virginia, they were all in this top tier of finalists. Some of the momentum that's really important, the wind at your back that these six cities are getting, I think they can benefit from that as well. We'll offer some very modest benefits, some training, some webinars, just some ways to benefit from the knowledge that other cities are of what they're learning. But really our focus will be on those six for 2 years.
If somebody wanted to follow one of these projects, is there a way to do that?
Yes, we have a blog, greenlaneproject.org, where we tell stories about all things related to protected bike lanes. We're a niche of a niche, but we are 1-800-PROTECTED-BIKE-LANES. So we write about what's happening not only in our focus cities, but in other cities. We write about some of the newest data and research that's emerging about the economic impacts of investments in protected bike lanes, safety, any issue really that would be interesting to practitioners, advocates, professionals, people who care about how their streets work.
You just cannot underestimate the economic impact of bringing bicycles back into the city. You just can't. And people all over the place, it's hard to explain what that economic impact is. You know, it brings vitality back to the main street, if you want to call it that.
It's hard to, but we're going to try.
Well, you're going to do fine. Other than the Green Lane Project, are you doing anything else at People for Bikes?
I am 100% focused on
okay.
the Green Lane Project.
Good.
We have a great team here. And,
yeah, you do.
We
yeah,
do.
You
do. Yeah, and we have a lot of work to do, and we've already started with the current six cities. We're going to be having the official launch in late April in Indianapolis.
Well, yeah. So it's greenlaneproject.org. It's all one word, Green Lane Project. And People for Bikes, Zach Vanderkoy, thank you so much for talking to me today. We will follow the Green Lane Project. Pittsburgh, is the rival of Cleveland, So we're here in Cleveland. We'll be watching what they do, and hopefully we can do it one day, too.
Well, maybe for the next phase of the Green Lane Project, Cleveland will be a strong contender.
That would be nice. Have a great afternoon, Zach. Thanks so much for talking to me.
Thank you.
Alrighty. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Zach Vanderkoy joined me from the offices of People for Bikes, where he is working with the Green Lane Project. Interesting project. You were saying something about Bike Cleveland?
Yeah, the way the separate lanes and everything that they're talking about with their projects, exactly what Cleveland, Bike Cleveland is looking to do with the city on Lorraine Road that we have here for 60 blocks.
60 blocks.
60 from 25th up to 85th, I think.
Well, we'll see if they make a pitch to the Green Lane Project next
year. Hopefully by then it should be pretty well along there. But, again, the great thing about this is somebody has to be first. And them being first makes it so much easier for every other city that's
right.
going to do this. And I think Cleveland will have that benefit from Pittsburgh going first. And we'll figure out what Pittsburgh does wrong, and then we can
beat
fix
them.
It. Yes.
Okay. All right. We'll be right back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Diane Lees.
And I'm Tim McKenna.
And this is WJCU.
So, I'm a dog, and I just got adopted by this new human guy, and I'm starting to wonder how he got along without me. I mean, okay, something as simple as walking around the block. He's got this leash thing, and he puts me on one end and him on the other, and I'm just taking him around. I think he's afraid of getting lost. Without that leash and me guiding him along, I don't think he'd find his way back home. But it's kind of cute.
A person is the best thing to happen to a shelter pet. Be that person. Adopt. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the ShelterPetProject.org.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Diane Lees.
And I'm Tim McKenna.
And I think we have time for some good news, as we like to say.
Well, let's go to the Geneva Auto Show.
Oh, well, okay.
We don't talk autos here, but the interesting thing about the Geneva Auto Show is there are two companies that decided to launch bicycles.
Seriously?
BMW.
Oh, seriously?
They've decided to launch a bike that is also, one version is an e-bike.
Okay.
And the second company is Kia. Kia actually started as a bicycle company.
That is true.
Then they went back to cars, and now they're launching a bicycle, which they also have a version that is an e-bike as well. And what's really neat about this is in Europe, it's not about selling cars as much as it is now they're selling bikes because there's a big interest.
What goes around comes around.
Yep.
That's cool. BMW and Kia, talk about, you know, sort of opposite ends of the spectrum. This comes from VeloNews Competitor Online, and the headline is Horner's Press Conference Snub at Tirreno, Nothing New. We tend to think of famous riders like Chris Horner as always being hounded for interviews. Well, evidently, that's not always the case. Gregor Brown wrote, Chris Horner was surprised that Tirreno Adriatico race organizers failed to invite him to Tuesday's Top Riders pre-race press conference. RCS Sports called in 13 of cycling's stars, but left the Vuelta a España winner off the guest list. I don't ever get invited to the press conferences, so it's nothing new, Horner told VeloNews. Maybe it's because I've only won one Grand Tour. I guess you have to win five. I was just as surprised as you, but that's happened my whole career. So it is what it is. The 42-year-old arrived in San Vincenzo, Italy, early ahead of his first UCI World Tour start with Lampre Merida, and said that he was available yesterday. He added, I could have shown up if someone asked me. So isn't that interesting that, you know, he just kind of like gets dissed for interviews? I don't quite understand what it is.
So somebody that is being invited,
yes,
possibly, the Giro d'Italia organizers, RCS Sport, they're considering a women's race to run alongside its top event.
Copycats.
Copycats, exactly. Two other organizations are doing the same this year, and the first one, the most famous, is the Tour.
Right.
They're going to run a women's race several hours on the very last day of the event for the men as they do their final ride. They'll have the women's races then. So it's good to see that we're getting more and more women's races that are going to get international attention and on a good stage.
Well, the question will be for me, will they be given equal pay as well as equal billing?
I'm going to guess not to get started, no.
Okay. Okay, I don't want to forget this. I forgot it last week. It's important. It's time to mention our good buddy, Rodney Hendrickson. The Red Bud Ride is coming up. This year, the mid-April, the 11th through the 13th ride, will offer up the usual gorgeous routes, their crazy fun rest stops, and a couple of extra goodies. So the Red Bud Ride is actually the 12th, Saturday. Friday and Sunday are going to round out the weekend with a couple of other Kentucky events. It's redbudride.com. And do you know what the Red Bud is? And don't say, like, from Panama or something.
No, I was going to say
they're
Colorado.
Trees.
But no. Of course they are.
Yeah, it's in London, Kentucky. You know, I always like to mention that ride because Rodney's such a cool guy. Okay, go ahead.
So one of the other interesting things that I found while looking on the internet this week was at a WordPress blog called Bikeable Joe. There's a neat little video that's on there. It's called The Spokesman from Dean Safran.
And Dean lives in Auckland, New Zealand, mate.
Mm-hmm. Right. And this is one of those. It's about a neat story about an elderly man by the name of James. And James' mission in life was to collect a bike from every different era. And there's all different kinds of bikes, from big wheels to state-of-the-art, latest things that they have now. And there's a neat link to that on the site.
It's a very pretty video. If you're interested, it's Bikeable Joe.
Bikeable Joe. And Joe is J-O.
Oh, okay. There's no E. All right. So this is a story with a good ending. It comes from the Daily Camera Boulder News this week. It became headline when John Sampson was arrested for stealing 43 bikes worth $147,000. It was over a five-month period in 2013. Boulder police arrested a 38-year-old man Monday who they believe is responsible for the theft of 43 high-end bicycles between May and September, including the five bikes stolen from the Boulder High School mountain bike team during last September's flood. I mean, talk about low. That's pretty low. The bikes were worth a total of $147,000, according to the Boulder police, and range in price from $700 to $9,000. Boulder police spokeswoman Kim Coble said detectives set up a bait operation in which they locked up an expensive bike downtown last year, and the suspect, John William Sampson III, appeared, quote-unquote, very interested in acquiring it, you think? She said Sampson also was wearing a backpack at the time that contained burglary tools. Sampson was on parole at the time and dealing with parole violations, Cobell said. After police apprehended him, Cobell said they connected him to the other bike thefts around the city. He knew what he was looking for as far as brands, and he was also very prepared with his tools, she said. None of the bicycles have been recovered, Cobell said. There are no leads regarding the bike's whereabouts, but police are still investigating.
Well, my favorite part about the whole thing. Well, obviously the favorite part is they caught him.
Right. Well, that is the best part.
But the other part was he was on parole for another violations.
Yeah, exactly. So, it's like, oh, well, let's just keep doing bad things. What do you think? All right. What you got?
Bicycle Week to celebrate cycling in Windsor and Detroit. North American Bicycling Week is March 27th through the 30th. And businesses and organizations on both sides of the border working together to celebrate cycling for the region's first North American Bicycle Week. The event is being organized by Detroit Bike City and Windsor Eats, along with bike-friendly Windsor Essex, Cycle Culture, the University of Windsor Cyclist Association. But it is good to see that more people are celebrating cycling.
That is true. So this is time sensitive. And if you are a female, if you are at least 18 years old, and if you are now working in a bicycle shop, QBP, which is Quality Bicycle Products, SRAM, and UBI, which is the United Bicycle Institute, are offering up to $4,000 in scholarship money to help advance your career. SRAM, QBP, and UBI are jointly offering two scholarships for female mechanics to attend the United Bicycle Institute. All three companies are dedicated to getting more women on bikes and want to support the development of female mechanics. The opportunity is open to aspiring or experienced bike mechanics and women who would like to increase their technical knowledge to further their career in the bike industry. The scholarship will cover either the one-week advanced certification seminars, which are ideal for more experienced mechanics, or the more intensive two-week professional shop repair and operations class for those with little or no mechanical experience. Open call for applications will close March 22nd. Scholarship winners will be notified by mail. I think you just have to go to QBP.com, and I think it's right on their main page. So, girls, ladies, if you're in the shop working on a bike, here's a chance to get further your mechanic education.
Did you happen to see the closer look at Oregon's plans for the Bike Pod Network?
I did.
Those look pretty neat. This looks like it'd be a neat project for a cycling group somewhere looking to take bicycle tourism to the next level and to solidify the direct connection between bicycling and economic development. Oregon State Parks wants to create a network of covered bike facilities that they say will redefine the cycling experience. The Oregon Parks and Recs Department, OPRD, called these facilities bike pods and bike hubs. And if all goes according to plan, there will eventually be 19 of them throughout the state, with the first one set for construction for this summer. Now, the interesting thing with these tiny little shelters with lockers and places, things that you can do to repair your bike, and there are some that also offer the ability to lock your bikes up so you can actually stay overnight.
Wow.
And if
you know what? I did see them because I saw the drawings.
Yep.
They're very cool.
They're very simple, very neat, but it's something that if you're going on a long ride, you know, a ride for an entire day, it's really nice to be able to it's a rest area for cyclists, basically, like you would have in your car, like we used to have, well, if you're old enough to remember, rest areas on the side of highways.
Well, they still have them all along the corridor on the Interstate 90.
Well, but they have McDonald's and all the other
fancy
stuff.
Well, that's true. These are a little more rustic.
Yeah, these are the old school.
So, that's all our news. We are going to head on over to Portland. We just got done talking about possibility of these pods, bike pods in Portland. And we are going to talk with Mike Cobb. He is the head of an organization that is doing disaster relief trials. Wait till you hear about this. Mike, welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for talking with me this evening.
Thanks, Diane. It's good to be here.
So I need you to tell me about the disaster relief trials. They sound so cool. What are they? When are they? Why are they? What are you doing?
Well, I want to start a conversation with decision makers, with emergency management people about the relevance of bicycles to disaster relief. So I decided to, and specifically cargo bikes to disaster relief. And so I thought that the best way to sort of break down some paradigms about bikes being toys might be to have a competition that is a de facto disaster relief drill performed by people on cargo bikes, basically going on a supply run through broken transportation infrastructure.
What a cool idea. It is such a cool idea. So you are the person who actually came up with this whole concept.
I did. After the Haiti disaster in 2010, my anguish about the delayed relief and about the incomplete relief led to looking for other answers, and I'm a bicycle person, and so I look at the world through the bicycle lens. And
why wouldn't it be a good tool in the toolbox to have access to cargo carrying bicycles that don't rely on anything that a normal infrastructure of society supports? No fuel required, doesn't require open roadways. Can operate without communications. So I started passing around the idea to Portland local bike advocates, and people, it passed the initial litmus test. People were really excited and encouraged me to come up with something.
Well, you're in the right place. I mean, there are not only a lot of cargo bikes in Portland, there are a lot of cargo bike manufacturers in Portland, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
So tell us how one of these trials work, and just take us through the the process of a trial.
Uh-huh. Well, there are 11 essential elements that I've come up with and have been codified by the local Portland Disaster Relief Trials Administration that provide a really good test of the capabilities specific to cargo bikes. And so basically the idea is to force people to navigate between addresses, and the addresses are assigned to checkpoints. And the best navigator will ride at least 30 miles. That's one of the essential elements. But there has to be, you know, the fastest riders will need to take at least 3 hours. So it's a It's a good half day task. And basically what it is it's a, it looks like a race, but we call it a spirited, scavenger hunt.
Okay.
and it's also has some relation to, alley cats, which are the sort of no holds barred, messengers type races.
Right.
But with us, following traffic laws is really important.
Okay.
And so it's, people are handed, to try to answer your question, more briefly. At the beginning of the event, an hour prior to the start, cargo cyclists are handed a laminated map and a nice little spring clamp that allows them to attach it to their handlebars. And on that map are between 8 and 11 checkpoints.
Okay.
And they are numbered, and they have to be visited in order. And these checkpoints represent either an obstacle, like a 1-meter barrier, or an off-road section that represents broken transportation infrastructure or a water crossing, or it involves picking up food, water, medicine, medical equipment.
Wow.
And so that's basically your spirited scavenger hunt. Go out and get things that would be authentically helpful to your neighbors who are perhaps not, their discomfort or their emergency doesn't rise within the triage system. It doesn't rise to the level of attention for professional first responders, but it is certainly important, an important need that might be addressed by an able-bodied neighbor who has a cargo bike and who has, you know, basic navigation skills and understanding of where the resources are.
So how many people might participate in one of your disaster relief trials?
We put the field limit at 50 last year, and that seems to be a good number to have a good fun competition and to display lots of different craft and technique. And also, because it's an open course competition, it's nice to keep the numbers manageable so that it's not too clumpy and sort of risky in the eyes of the police.
Do you have women participating as well as men?
Absolutely, yeah. And we have equal poultry, but equal prizes for both men and women.
Oh, there are prizes. How nice.
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. It never occurred to me that there would be prizes. I would think, you know, it's the altruistic, I'm doing it because it's a cool thing to do. So who are the people who normally participate in this? Are these people who have any first responder training, or are they just, you know, citizens?
We definitely attract some amateur radio operators.
Oh, cool.
Who also play a significant role in the event, and communication from ham radio operators is one of the essential elements of the disaster relief trials competition. So we get some of those people who actually want to compete more than they want to help with the administration of the event. And we also get neighborhood emergency team leaders. That's the name of a local city-funded organization that involves peer-to-peer assistance in the event of a disaster, and includes some allocated resources like fire extinguishers and maps and communication devices. So those kind of people get turned on by this citizen-led disaster drill. But then we also have a lot of, in Portland, I think it's fair to say that the primary cargo bike user is a parent who transports kids and groceries and everything that a car might transport. So we get a good percentage of people who are turned on by the utility of the cargo bike and are involved in the bike community, and who are, yeah, Joe and Josephine Citizen, who, you know, are parents, young parents who don't need a car to raise a family.
I'm speaking with Mike Cobb. He is the, what do you call yourself? What is your title?
I'm the conspirator.
He's the conspirator of the disaster relief trials. A really interesting. I think it's fascinating. It's such a cool idea. So Portland is one. Did I see while I was doing my research that Seattle is doing a disaster relief trial too?
Yeah, they're going to have their second annual this summer.
So are people beginning to look at this as not just the competition that it is, but as a viable way of bringing disaster relief in cities like Portland, like Seattle? It seems to me that it makes a lot of sense if your buses aren't running, if your cars aren't running, if, you know, that suddenly you have a disaster. I mean, we've had a bunch of disasters here lately with infrastructure, you know, broken water mains and all kinds of stuff, that it would be a cool thing to have these cargo bikes being able to help people.
Yeah. You know, we've had really heartening and encouraging response from the city and county emergency management groups and also FEMA.
Really?
Region 10, yeah. They've provided staff assistance for the Seattle event, first annual, and for the second annual Portland event. FEMA is actively encouraging citizen preparedness efforts, and so this fits right into their style and some of what they're promoting. So it's very much right now proliferating, and it's I think we're getting ready for step two, which is okay. We've tested cargo bikes. We've displayed their abilities and the relevance of those abilities to citizen-led disaster relief. Now, how can they be incorporated into a disaster plan for your metropolis? You know, is it a matter of this is when the concept of resilience comes up, a popular word right now to describe communities that have less dependence on infrastructure grids and therefore are more sustainable and therefore are ready for disaster-induced disruptions of infrastructure. And so it's just the timing is, I think, just about right to start to talk about cargo bikes being a really important increaser of resilience in a community, and how do you capitalize on that the best? Well, I think city car share organizations and bike share organizations and tool lending libraries are already showing us how we might increase use of cargo bikes to be more resilient and to be more prepared for disaster relief.
Also brings to mind what goes on in places like Alaska, where they use sleds and dogs, that suddenly you can deliver emergency supplies by using a bike. It just makes perfect sense to me. So
These
are events. Do you have sponsors for your events then? People who are, how are you getting your prizes? How are you, you know, getting streets involved? I mean, tell me how your event works. If I said to you, we want to do a disaster relief trial here in Cleveland, what would be my first rule? What would I have to do first?
Well, get a hold of me and we'll get you linked up to shared documents for the open source style of creating one of these events.
Okay.
There are cargo bike manufacturers who are already turned on to the idea and who have helped generously in Seattle and Eugene and Portland, and right now I'm helping Chicago, New York City, and San Francisco organizers set up disaster relief trials, and I'm trying to gather some sponsorship funds specifically for the big three city series, and I wish I had some deals sealed right now, but I'm close with a couple manufacturers of providing some real assistance so that we can have there's one chance for a first impression in these big cities that I mentioned. I want to do it. I want to go all the way.
I would think somebody like the Red Cross would be interested in this kind of event. Or I know that they're a nonprofit, but they get involved in all kinds of stuff. It's just so cool. Or like foundations. We have a couple here, like the Cleveland Foundation, and I can't remember. There are a couple of others. The Gund Foundation. It's just such a great idea. I love it. So cool.
Yeah, the county and city emergency management agencies put down some real cash to help our second annual event. And Red Cross has been a partner mostly with materials, authentic materials for a medical supply run. And they've let us use their regional headquarter parking lot. So yeah, we've managed to make good partnerships, either with financial assistance or staff assistance or general endorsement, and so these are all things that can be used as evidence that it's a legitimate idea, and your city should try it out as well.
So if people want to find out about it, tell us what the URL is. What's your website?
Well, right now, Portland has a WordPress website, and it's simply drttdx.wordpress.
Okay. I just think it's a very, very cool idea. We'll be watching this. I think it would be fun, don't you? It's kind of fun with a very serious undertone.
Exactly.
That I think makes a lot of sense. We have one shop here in town that is very focused on cargo bikes, and he listens to the show. So, hey, Mike, if you're listening, do you like this idea? And his name happens to be Mike. Well, Mike Cobb, Mr. Disaster Relief Trials Conspirator, thank you so much for talking to me this afternoon, and I wish you a lot of luck with getting your sponsors for your three big eastern cities.
Thank you, Diane. I enjoyed the session.
And we'll talk again.
Okay.
Have a good
Bye-bye.
Night. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Mike Cobb joined me from his home in Portland, Oregon. I think this is a cool idea.
I think this could easily take off in a lot of places. And one of the things I thought during the interview was, we talk about all the technology that we have, and we've got these drones that can fly all over the place. But the drones can only carry so much.
Right.
And you need a human to get to all of these places. And
right.
I think cycling is that's an exact way to do this.
Well, and a cargo bike can carry a lot of stuff. That's what it's meant for, hence the name cargo. I don't think the way they're built, I don't think they're hard to handle. I just think it's a cool idea. And perhaps we'll see one on the East Coast so that we can go see how one works and maybe suggest one here to the Bike Cleveland people. What
yep.
do you think? All right. Well, that's all we have time for on the Outspoken Cyclist this evening. Thank you so much for joining us. Next week, it's Congressman Earl Blumenauer and a wrap-up of the National Bike Summit. Have a great weekend. Happy St. Patrick's Day. Wear green. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on the Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next Saturday evening from 5:30 to 6:30 here on WJCU 88.7 FM and streaming live on the internet at WJCU.org. Don't forget, this show is available as a downloadable podcast also at WJCU.org, and we're on Facebook at The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.